he was extraordinarily spiritual. In some sense, the evangelical instinct that he had, even as a teenager, never left him right through his Catholic years. He then had this profound kind of instinctual sense that there were just two great realities that could not be denied, himself and God, or rather, God and himself. But that stays throughout as a kind of leitmotif of his entire life. When he comes to look at the development of the church, he looks at it very much in terms of a kind of a psychological development of the church as a kind of person, and indeed as the person of Christ, but as a human person who grows cognitively, grows developmentally, emotionally, and every other way. It's like the church is this one great person before God, learning to become more godlike. And then when he comes later in his life to deal with the other greatest of his themes, conscience, again, we're left with this dramatically sort of spiritualized, theological, but deeply psychological sense of one person before God being attentive to a voice that makes the difference and that tells him that there's something, there's a set of values that lies outside himself, which he cannot account for simply by looking internally.
You know, I'm reminded when you were speaking there of, first of all, let's take the whole organic nature of things developing. That was very important for him, and different from an understanding maybe of a more static notion of who we are and who the church is.
Yeah, very much the dominant sort of thought pattern in the 19th century was that everything about the church was unchangeable. There was a dramatic emphasis on the transcendental, the suprahistorical, the idea of the grand, unchanging, absolute fact of God and God's things. And for Newman, this was problematic because it made no accommodation for the ordinary changes which occur in the course of church history. I mean, Newman found himself saying we must start with the church as a fact of history, and we've got to account for it, not explain it away. We have to make sense of the fact that there was no clear Christological doctrine for 300 years after Christ's death. There was no clear Trinitarian doctrine, no clear doctrine that said Father, Son, and Spirit are consubstantial until nearly 400 years after Christ's death. Marian doctrines took longer still. So too did penitential traditions, the structure of the sacraments, all of these things. How do we make provision for a church that is able to change in these respects and in other respects, sometimes dramatically? How do we do so without having a kind of a theory that accommodates the historical and does not try to rest everything on the unchangeable?
Now, that's interesting, because today Newman is in the spotlight again, and not just for being made a saint, but he's been appropriated by people on both sides of what might be called the very conservative side of the Catholic Church and the more liberal side. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, it's a curious phenomenon, because we now have both people who, sadly, are often at each other's throats in the church these days. Pope Francis's conservative critics and Pope Francis's progressive defenders, I suppose. It's a little bit of a trite division, but it holds. And they're both very pleased to hear that Newman is to become a saint later on this year. Each of them will invoke the same notion in Newman in particular, that is his theory of the development of doctrine, but they have two very different takes on it. For the conservatives, Newman's understanding of the development of doctrine is that doctrine may only develop in a way that's completely internally, organically consistent, the way an acorn may only become an oak tree. An infant will become a man or a woman according to its kind. That there is this necessary progressive development that absolutely limits the manner and the direction in which the development take place. For the more progressive people, Newman's understanding of development is more ample, it's more subtle, and more complex than that allows. And it is true that Newman does take images of strict organic development as an explanation or as a kind of model of dogmatic development in the church. He does take instances of infants and acorns and things, but he adds to that the idea of a psychological development, their understanding of the world around them. They come up with simplistic understandings when they're young. The understanding deepens later. They correct older misunderstandings. They go down blind alleys. They correct themselves. They experiment with one way of looking at things. They are exposed to outside ideas. They appropriate them or assimilate them, to use Newman's word. And that has its own effect. And all of this, which may look, as Newman is very clear in his essay on development, which may look like it is wayward, may look like it is a little bit, let's say, out of control, if one looks at it closely, one could see that underlying it all, there is what he calls a preservation of type. And this allows, and Newman is clear, that one of the, what he sees as the sources of corruption in religion is not, is the people who stay faithful in every last detail to what they have received, but fail to move with the developments in that, in the teachings.
Tell me, for you then, as a historian and as somebody very interested in matters of faith, what that means concretely today that Newman is offering, because we see Pope Francis is under fire very much from an alt-right who are very nervous and vitriolic about the changes he's brought in, say even in relation to the death penalty, and saying that he is changing church doctrine and is in almost schism or heresy.
Yeah, I think one way of looking at what's at the tension that's evident in the church at the moment is to look at the Second Vatican Council, because this really is the watershed event. Newman is often seen as being, and in fact Pope Paul VI referred to him as being, a kind of a father of the council. The difference which Newman made to the new theologians of the 20th century, Yves Congar, Henri de Lubac, Jean-Daniel Leu, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, all these, the greats of the 20th century, the fact that Newman gave them this historicist approach to understanding Christian doctrine and its development, that fed into the council, and it made the council doubly attentive. One, to back to its sources, the ressourcement, the return to the sources, back to scripture and the early tradition of the church, but also the second one, which came under the rubric of aggiornamento, being attentive to one's own time, to staying up to date. You're looking in two directions at once, and you're holding this, a kind of a creative tension to keep these two things together. The earliest pristine spirit of the church and the concrete reality that's in front of you. The tendency, and Newman had identified this as a tendency in the Anglicans that he left behind when he joined the church in 1845, the tendency is to give foreground prioritization to antiquity. We must always refer everything back to the past. And Newman was saying this is the failure to recognize where development might bring you, the failure to respond to the concrete reality that you're facing. I happen to think that it's Francis and it's Francis's defenders who are right in their way of invoking Newman and Newman's development of doctrine. I think that Newman would very much be along the side that Francis is with regard to holding these two very different sort of frames of value together. What we have received and what we are facing. That's what brought Newman into the church, and it's very much what the Second Vatican Council was doing. But nowadays, what we've had is, sadly, a great number of the conservatives in the church who were broadly in favour of the Second Vatican Council, so long as it was what they saw as being its excesses were restrained by conservative popes. Now, with Francis, have said, oh, we should have seen it all along. The problem was the council itself. What we must do is try to get the council negatived and go back to the time before the council was there. And this is, I think, the great error of antiquarianism. This is the failure to pay due attention to the God-given, concrete historical moment that one lives in.
To conclude, are you happy that he is going to be made a saint and that this man did give so much? I mean, he spoke beautifully about change. To grow is to change, and to change often is to become perfect. Is that correct? You mentioned conscience, the importance that he put on conscience, and that would have influenced documents in the council, Dignitatis Humanae and things like that. What's your summary of this man that you've written and read about for so many years?
I think I'll go back to where I started, which is to say that canonization is about personal holiness. And Newman is the intellectual giant that I've been describing, But again, what underlies all that, and what kind of animates all of what he did, what he said with regard to development, education too, I've left that out, but that's very important. His sense of kind of an integrated intellectual life, very important. How important it is for Catholics. His founding of the Catholic University in Ireland is one instance. Various efforts to try to get Catholics to engage with Oxford is another. Then, as you say, conscience and other matters of that kind. What animated his entering into any of these things was a profoundly selfless attention to the values that were important, whether he found them easy to support or not. They needed to be pursued and they needed to be revered. What I like about him, and I'm going to be a little bit perverse here, what I like about him in particular too is that he was a very sensitive man, oversensitive at times, and there's no doubt about it. You cannot read the life of Newman, you cannot see the complications in Newman's personal relations without seeing how much he smarts under the lash, a phrase he uses more than once himself, you know, of people disregarding him or people taking him up the wrong way, which they often did because he was very much more subtle than many of his detractors. But it hurt him not. But also he was hurt, people talking behind his back, people having his works delated to Rome on suspicion of heresy, in one case by a bishop who later came back crawling to him, begging him to come with him as a paretus to the First Vatican Council, which he turned down. But over and over again, people, even if he tried to hold out the hand of friendship, sometimes he got his wrist slapped, and it always hurt. And I think it was a deep, deep personal sensitivity. Friendship for him was an all-important matter. And, you know, this is a very different from the highly intellectual Newman we're talking about, because he took as his motto, he had the phrase, cor ad cor loquitur, one heart talks to another heart. And this is what he saw his whole life is doing.